Hello and welcome. I'm Sam Harris, and it is my true honor and pleasure to host you here on the Growth Mindset podcast. I talk to amazing individuals about how they achieve their dreams and break down the strategies it takes to lead explosive tech businesses to being paid to travel the world. I deep dive into topics such as Bitcoin and fintech, or just how to get stuff done, with the goal of increasing our own collective wisdom and making us all happier, healthier, and wealthier. Who doesn't want that?
On the podcast today, we have Rob Price, an English teacher, an author, and a philosopher working in Thailand and soon moving to China. He has some really interesting views on the world, and he was a really great guy to chat about life and things with when I spent time with him over Christmas in December 2017. On the podcast, we discuss a variety of things, from the topics of teaching and just being useful to the world and traveling, to such things as nuclear winters or AI taking over the world, human beings taking over the galaxies, and what is the point of living and why no one will read books in the future. So it's certainly a great podcast for anyone who likes to think about the future and the point of things, and Rob has a great way of just unpicking what humans tend to believe versus what's actually true in a given situation, and I certainly learned a lot during the conversation, and I hope you do too. I do just have to apologise for some of the recording. My voice sounds a bit off on the whole thing, but Rob sounds great and I don't talk too much. And there is a lot of birds in the background, but I think that sounds lovely and I hope you enjoy the birds.
Can you quickly introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name's Rob Price. I'm an English teacher, both in the sense of being English and in the sense of teaching English.
Yeah.
My degree was in literature and I taught whatever you want to call it, high school, senior school, English, for 5 years in the UK. And since then, I've been traveling around Asia and also teaching in Bangkok, in a international school in Bangkok. I guess that's my work. Then sort of my research interests are various, very various, but completed a master's quite recently in philosophy of education, which is a sort of interesting either niche or dead end of philosophy, depending on how you want to look at it.
So firstly, how come you started traveling and teaching as opposed to being a normal person?
Oh, well, I wanted to travel, but I definitely wanted to be useful when I traveled. So my first concern was not to just show up in a place and have nothing to contribute. I mean, I think that's still a large aspect of my life. So when I first realized I wanted to know more about the world, I suppose I was about 17, 18, like a lot of people realize at that age. And my first thought is, okay, I'd like to go and do some voluntary work. So I started to investigate this and I found out pretty early on that you are really not, as a 17 or 18 year old, equipped with any kind of transferable skill that anyone could be or would be interested in having, particularly in the developing world. So I thought I'd better wait until I felt like I would be useful. And it's only recently, when I turned about 30, and I've been teaching for a few years, I thought, okay, I'm probably useful now. I'm probably useful in a country like Thailand. So I decided to go and try and make myself useful. I definitely did not want to, as a comedian I know put it recently, somehow leverage just speaking English into a profession. I know that that might sound a little harsh to TEFL teachers, but and some of them are excellent. I work with a number of really excellent English as a second language teachers, but I've also met TEFL teachers whose goals are, shall we say, not what mine are philosophically and educationally.
Okay, a lot of people do go away to find themselves and work in an orphanage or something, but it is sort of a bit pointless when basically you're only there because they want your money and you pay like $3,000 or $7,000 to go and like just help them build some decking or something, and it's pointless. And
sure, just send $2,000 and then spend the other £1,000 on a holiday. You know, like, it's fine. If you want a holiday, have a holiday. That's always been my attitude. But you know, you have to earn the money for a holiday.
Okay, cool. And so do you find that you get a lot more out of it then because of your
actually able to teach people more deeply, and you get to be more ingrained in the culture and you get to find things.
Sure. So I think that you get a number of things out of teaching that are not monetary. I do think that the feeling of being useful is very real, and is ultimately what's addictive about teaching. So I've certainly changed the way I teach in Thailand compared to the way I taught in London. I taught in London for 5 years, and in London, focus is very much on social mobility and also equality, right? You know, you're working in the UK in a very unequal society, and I was working with kids who maybe lacked opportunity, and I was very much focused on how could I get them access to a different kind of life, to the life that a lot of them were facing. That's not a problem to the kids in an international school. They are going to have a very nice quality of life. So in some ways, their goals are much more straightforward. They want to speak really excellent English. And so what I teach and the way I teach has changed drastically, because what's addictive is a student being grateful. And not all students literally say thank you. Some do. But students show gratitude to teachers in different ways, and that is the buzz. That's when you know you've succeeded. For me, it was when I started teaching them very, very specific and useful pieces of language. For example, I think one of the most useful things I've taught recently is the difference between might, could, should, can, and will. Which to a native English speaker, you just use intuitively.
Yeah.
That's ridiculously hard to explain and took a lot of thought in order to deliver. But when you then hear students and see in writing students using those words correctly, or even using them incorrectly, but just trying.
Yeah.
As opposed to just evading it, that's incredibly addictive.
What made you choose the places you traveled to? Was it just where happened to be the opportunities that came up?
The honest answer is I had a family friend had moved to Bangkok many years ago.
Yeah.
And he had seemed like someone who did his own thing. And so I kind of followed his lead. I thought, yeah, he seems pretty free. He seems to have just done what he wanted. I'll do that. Which might seem paradoxical, and probably is paradoxical, but, you know, whatever. And as for the actual travel destinations, I'm married to a geography teacher, so I pretty much just go off what she tells me is an interesting place to visit. My interests are more in history, so I can tell her where was interesting, you know, 2,000 years ago, but you'll get there and it'll just be a bunch of rocks. Mm. And once you've seen rocks, you have seen them. I'm kind of over rocks ruins. Anywhere. Exactly, right? Mm. I want to see something alive. So I just ask her what's going on.
Okay, cool. Yeah, have you been to any like international development crisis areas?
I haven't been in a crisis. The most, you know, there is a crisis going on in Myanmar at the moment, and that was going on when we visited. So a kind of moral, there's some interesting moral questions there. And have you been to Myanmar?
No, but I'm going next year.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really only just opened for the globalized world. Yeah, it's very close to change. Yeah. So put it this way: most of the products in the shops are still manufactured just in Myanmar by businesses who are, you know, relatives of the military regime.
Yeah.
So it's like you'll buy a packet of crisps and there'll be like a dude's name on it, and that's the brother-in-law of the general who one of the high-ranking generals in the junta. So it's like you're just eating these sort of military-sanctioned crisps.
Yeah.
And those are the crisps. Those are the crisps you can get. So, it's changing. It's changing fast.
Okay, on to the fact that you're writing a screenplay. So you've written stuff before, or you just felt this is the time that you need to get this out of you?
I've written academically, and I have written with varying degrees of success academically.
Okay, what does that mean exactly?
I wrote, like a lot of people write, I wrote a dissertation. That's the longest thing I wrote, is my master's dissertation, which I wasn't happy with. And ultimately, I don't think that the discipline of academic writing is that interesting to me. So I kind of went back to what I enjoy about teaching, actually. And what I enjoy about teaching is taking a story that I know is interesting and convincing other people to be interested in it. And I think that is scope for that in terms of how we write for the screen, really. I think most people now consume most of their narrative through screens. I don't think that there are a huge number of readers of literary fiction, and I think that sales figures indicate that it's falling all the time. I actually think that what we're seeing at the moment is a kind of correction. I think there was never in history was there a time where most people read or expected to be readers or were expected to consume by sitting in silence and reading, unless you were like a monk or something. I think there is a kind of unashamed elitism in the way I regard literature.
Yeah.
Having said that, I do think it's also important that as many people have access to the very real goods that that kind of narrative can bring. So much in the same way as, you know, no one read the Bible, but everyone looked at stained glass windows and thought, hey, those windows are really cool. Similarly, or you know, maybe you didn't read Homer because you were some poor Greek peasant, but you could look at Achilles on a pot and think that Achilles looked pretty awesome there. Like he's really fucking that guy up. Like go on Achilles. Like that's essentially what I think that the cinema and also increasingly like Netflix do really. So I just see my project at the moment as an extension of my teaching, really, is trying to put literature in a form where people don't have to be bullied or coerced or baited into reading it. I really don't think anyone should be bullied into reading literature. It's just there if you want it. Having said that, if I can make it as accessible as possible, more and more people can benefit from the good.
That's cool. So what is it that you want to teach people with your screenplay that you're writing?
I don't even see myself as teaching people. I would see myself as putting them in contact with someone who has something to say to them.
What are the stories that you want people to understand? So
there are a number of writers who I think could get a lot more, who could be appreciated a lot more because they have, I think, something important to say about where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of so one is a guy called H.P. Lovecraft, who a fair number of people know who he is. He's not unknown, and people would recognize like his main creations, but I don't think that people would really read him. He doesn't write in a way that is accessible or enjoyable for a modern audience. That doesn't mean the stories aren't good. You know, people don't read Greek, but you know, people are still enjoying the stories of Homer.
Okay, so what does H.P. Lovecraft to teach people?
He teaches people a type of fear, which I think is very relevant to the time we're in, which is not a fear of God, because no one believes in God. Most people don't believe in God.
Coming from a Christian.
Well, yeah, and I'm realistic about this, like. People don't go to church in the country I'm from. And as a Christian, I do think the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. But like those are just words if you don't know the fear of God. But what people are very realistically afraid of and rightly afraid of is the sort of scientific catastrophes that they have in their minds. You know, sort of experimentation gone too far, ecological collapse, aliens. Yeah, those are fairly rational fears.
Yeah.
You know, increasingly artificial intelligence gone mad. And I think that Lovecraft wrote a type of horror, groundbreaking horror, which was based on science. He was a very skilled amateur scientist for his time, and put all of these incredible references to absolutely groundbreaking scientific discoveries. An example. In the story Whisperer in Darkness, a race of fungoid insects from Yugoth are stealing people's brains and placing them in jars. And Yugoth is it transpires, Pluto. Now, Pluto had been discovered, I think, 3-4 years earlier, maybe even the year he started writing it, I think. It might even have been as early as that. He was super interested in the latest breakthroughs in astronomy. And he happened to know that we'd found a new planet, and he put it immediately into his stories. Now, I just think with a few tweaks, the elements are there for people to have a really good time and, and get really scared.
So, like, did you read much like H.G. Wells or the guy that wrote Jurassic Park?
Like, Crichton? Yeah, I read Crichton's stuff a long time ago.
So many of them are like basically perfect science almost with like a few little bits of like imagination, right?
And maths. He was a really, he was super educated. He was Harvard educated, MD. Super smart. The problem with Crichton, I think, is he seemed to regard his audience as I feel like the tone of his work is patronizing, and for that reason I'm kind of opposed to him in some ways, in a way that I'm not with another writer who whose work I think I could be with very very minor adaptations could be adapted for the screen with enormous popularity, and that's David Foster Wallace. You know, Wallace was a contemporary of Crichton's, and he used to say, you know, when his book Infinite Jest made this enormous commercial success, unheralded commercial success, really, for a work of literary fiction, people would ask him this question, say, like, how does it feel to be selling up there with Michael Crichton? And he would say, well, it makes me wonder if maybe I've screwed up. You know, like, you know, because he essentially regarded Crichton as something of a con man. There is something suspect about someone who is highly educated trying to come off like an ordinary Joe. And that's kind of why I don't read Crichton anymore. I just feel like there's this tension between, it's like he thinks that in order to get the ideas across, he has to pretend to be dumb.
Yeah.
Because he thinks we're dumb. I don't think you do. I don't think you have to pretend to be dumb. People don't read literary fiction because they're busy.
There's a difference between like making things understandable and talking down.
Oh, completely. Exactly right. And, you know, that's why truly great TV and truly great cinema starts from the assumption that the public will solve this puzzle you're putting before them. You don't have to tell them. They're smart. They're just busy, right? Yeah. And like, or they feel busy, which amounts to the same thing. The effect is the same. And that's why people don't read. People, you know, you hear people say, I don't have time to read. So my students say it to me all the time.
Yeah, the priorities, right?
But that's my values. Those are my values. That there is a right priority. I don't know what's going on in people's lives. I really don't. I certainly don't think that my students, the ones I'm thinking of who don't read, are lazy. Like a lot of them are, you know, I have one girl, she falls asleep in class all the time. You know, she dances like 3 hours a night. She just wants to dance. Like, how am I meant to convince her to stop dancing? She doesn't care. So it's not that I need to be as stupid, quote unquote stupid, as she is in order to make her understand something. I just need to give it to her in a form.
Yeah, where she can be receptive to it.
Yeah, she can take the she can take what good is there and make something of it, hopefully, make meaning from it. Because ultimately lives without meaning are very sad.
Mm.
And that's the good that literature offers.
Okay. So that kind of moves into then the Infinite Jest. And what is the meaning of life if you should be happy the whole time?
So Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, which I just think someone has to make some form of adaptation of this urgently to get this message out. But it's set in the very near future, where the Canada and Mexico and America have fused. They've formed a treaty, which is called the Order of North American Nations, or ONAN for short. Now, if you know your Bible, ONAN is the first masturbator of the Bible, you know, the actual biblical verses. And ONAN spilt his seed upon the ground, which was a shame upon him, which was a disgrace to him.
I was wondering if you'd said as in someone who debates to the masses, or like masturbator.
No. Okay. Jerking off, right? Yeah. Yes. So Onan is the first person in the first masturbator in literary history, first wanker. And so Wallace's conceit is that America has realized its destiny, see, in infinite jest, and has just become a completely solipsistic nation.
Yeah.
Like utterly solipsistic. And Wallace isn't alone in this. For many literary writers, solipsism is the great fear. Hmm. The idea that we can be sufficient to ourselves and need nothing else is terrifying to someone whose value system is constructed really around trying to feel empathy for people who lead radically different kinds of lives. The story itself is partly a kind of sick joke on this theme, this idea that Americans are being entertained to death.
Yeah.
And specifically being entertained by television, I suppose. So there is an irony in me thinking that this would make a great Netflix special, but then, you know, what's Black Mirror if not exactly the same kind of irony, right? And themes from it crop up everywhere. Mm. It's been called an unfilmable book, but the essential point of it is a very old story, which is just the Golden Fleece, right? It's just the story of the Golden Fleece. There is a object. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants it. A gang of misfits kind of comes together to go look for it. And in this case, the object is this videotape. Which, if you watch it, you fall into a state of, and I'm quoting here, catatonic bliss, such that you desire nothing other than to watch it indefinitely. Now, this sort of links to the conversation we had about if an AI, for example,
was given the task of making humans happy, if it was a super AI and like it take control of everything, it would, like, unbeknownst to anyone, infiltrate the entire world. In a split second, it would suddenly, like, using arms to sort of infiltrate everyone's brains and just permanently stimulate them to be eternally happy.
Yeah.
And everyone would just lie there being in bliss for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. I've heard it put differently as to tile the universe with rat brains on heroin, which is, you know, amounts to the same thing. And this is what this tape would do. In Infinite Jest, the tape would induce this catatonic bliss. And it's grotesque, right? People who watch it lose their dignity. They lose everything about them that we regard as human. Or, you know, I once asked a friend of mine, like, this question when we were having an argument. I said, well, look, if there was an ecstasy tablet from which you never came down, would taking it be an act of suicide? Because I kind of think it would. In as much as we would lose everything that makes us human if we lost our a relationship to the world that wasn't just pleasurable. I'm not saying by the way that suffering is good. I don't think suffering is good, but I think there might be a third thing
that we're
missing here.
Because humans, we're kind of used to getting more long-term fulfillment from working towards something and building a family or having a job that leads to you making something or writing books and achieving fame, and these are the things you kind of aspire to for, like, long-term fulfillment as opposed to just like momentary joy.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, the difference between what I want now and what I want most.
Yeah.
although having said that, you know, in the book, Wallace talks about a study where rats had electrodes inserted into their brains that triggered exactly this catatonic bliss. And that's how that's essentially you've killed the rat then. The rat can never come back from that type of catatonic bliss. And in the story, he says, and the results were published, and the next day the lab had a queue going three blocks down of people who were like queuing up to experience this. So there are plenty of people who would see that as a desirable end state. But that's utilitarianism. That's something that utilitarianism cannot really account for. The problem of what else is there other than pleasure and pain?
Hmm. Yeah. I know it's hard to really know, isn't it? In the same as in not necessarily an AI that's given the task of making us ultimately happy, but if in the future you can just plug in a button and say you go into your VR world or something, but actually it just makes you infinitely happy, why would you ever want to leave that if you then go into the real world again, deal with stuff? Because same reason people chase drugs and things now.
Yeah, I mean, and why do people get off drugs? I mean, I would say usually there are variants on this story, but people tend to say something like, what it was doing to my parents. I realized how much suffering I was causing. My friends, people have various moments, but they tend to, those moments don't tend to be solipsistic. Those moments of realization where you're thinking, I have to get off this path, tends to come with the arrival of or return of someone to one's life. So, you know, I met someone I fell in love. I had a child. My parents threw me out of the house. You know, like, these are the stories. So this goes to this second thread that Wallace develops later in his writing, in his unfinished book, Pale King, where he talks about the social contract and how really it is about how important belonging is to humans.
Yeah.
That stops us becoming monsters.
Definitely. Cool. So what happens if everyone else is also in the same cycle and there's no one to ever pull you back?
Well, you get the end of Rome.
Yeah.
You get the fall of Rome there. Eventually, everything falls apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. It's the story of how empires fall, which may well be what is happening right now. And if it is, depending on your point of view, what we either have to look forward to or have to live in terror of is a vertiginous fall into an abyss of our own making.
Yeah.
However, there is an opportunity here, really, for redemption, which I am ideologically inclined to believe can be mediated by art.
Okay.
But I'm aware of how absurd that sounds. I just think it can be.
Okay. Can you define that a bit better? Like,
yeah, sure. I think that we need to just choose better heroes.
Mm-hmm.
We need to choose heroes who are more complex and more admirable and emulate them.
Yeah. Okay.
And live like that. So that might not necessarily mean choosing the best soldier.
Yeah.
The best soldier, in fact, might be a type of hero who was better suited to a different stage of human development. We might now be at the point, for example, where we need to somehow, and I'm struggling to put this together, but somehow celebrate normality or somehow celebrate being part of something bigger. I think an interesting example of this is the Christopher Nolan film Inception, which is the story of a man trying to get back to his family. That is what Leonardo DiCaprio's character is doing in that film. And he is also someone who is not shown to be very capable, not shown to be very exceptional even. And in the end, his reward, quote unquote, for all of this bullshit he has to go through in the film, which is really irrelevant, his reward is he becomes anonymous. And I don't know if that struck you when you saw that film, but his reward is he disappears back into the crowd.
Yeah.
And no one, he's in the airport, he gets off the plane, no one knows who he is.
Yeah.
He's done. That's it. Well done. So it's very much not about being the one or the chosen or the most important. It is about actually doing an immense amount of work in order for no one to know your name.
Yeah, it seems a bit like communist and sort of going in the direction like North Korea and all this, working towards something else and like a lesser playing field. If we sort of cut ourselves off from like some of the inventions and amazing abilities that we have as mankind, to just stay in a place where we can derive meaning from doing more stuff as opposed to having AI that does everything for us and we kind of make mankind pointless.
I can see why you would say that. And I think the type of agrarian communism or North Korean ideology that you're talking about is completely suffused with nostalgia for the past. I mean, so for example, everyone in North Korea has to wear 1950s hairstyles because the 1950s was when the dictator's father or grandfather, whoever, was in power. And he liked those hairstyles, so everyone has to like those hairstyles. I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true. But I do think that there is no such thing as an individual without a group.
Yeah.
Groups produce individuals in discussion and dialogue. And individuals who can't be part of groups can't even be themselves. And I think you see that. I do think you see that in certain types of despair. So certain types of depression, for example, produce people who feel like they are completely alone in the world. And rather than that making them more individual, it in fact makes them completely anonymous.
Yeah.
I think they would themselves say that they were nobody. David Foster Wallace's own struggle with depression seems to have been worked through in his writing in order to kind of get him to this point where he was almost writing about how important the social contract was in order to cling on to it.
So what will be your main predictions that the world will be like in 5 years' time?
I don't think that there'll be more people reading. I think there'll be fewer people reading. And I think the spoken voice will just get more and more important. Once the voice-activated functionality on machines gets really, really good, which is practically there, there'll be very little reason even to know how to write anymore. Yeah. So what I do will kind of become a little bit like learning to ride a horse.
Yeah.
It's like something you do if you're into that kind of thing. With the important, I suppose, difference that there is a kind of magic that only people who read and write a lot know about, that I think has universal human application. Whereas if I just ride a horse, like, it's good for me, but it doesn't help anyone else.
Yeah.
So that would be my prediction. People just won't read.
Okay. Interesting. Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's true. Like, you get more and more information from podcasts and audiobooks than I ever used to.
Well, we're just returning to an earlier stage.
Yeah.
It's a correction. It's not like, and this is why I'm not nostalgic. This is just how things have always been. Hardly anyone was ever literate in human history.
True.
This is vanishing. This world.
It takes time to sit and read.
Yeah, and the only reason to train so many people is because the empire needed clerks.
Yeah.
I mean, once the entire clerical class has been replaced by super competent AIs,
what's the point?
Right? You don't even need to produce them.
What would you do if you had 2 hours a day extra?
Waste them. Without doubt.
That's true.
That's if you gave them to me now.
Yeah.
If I
could say you went back 10 years and without even feeling like you're doing work, you just did 2 hours on something.
Every day.
Yeah.
For the last 10 years.
You actually were asleep, but it actually was... something was created or you learned something.
I would have done three things. I would have created pieces of music, pieces of art, pieces of writing.
Okay.
It just happens to be, I've always gone between those three things since I was a child. And I'm drawn naturally to one as my interest and the other to wanes, and I've just bounced between them. And I always have. So it would just be some combination of those. Whether what I make is ever commercially successful is not what's interesting to me. I just would have made more of it.
You're creating.
Cool. What is your favorite or most memorable childhood memory?
I suppose it's a day when some friends and I got hold of a boat and spent the day throwing rancid potatoes at each other by a riverbank, from the boat and from the bank, and taking it in turns. Because we also found a sack full of rancid potatoes, and we arrived home covered in green slime and stinking and very, very happy.
Yeah.
And bleeding as well. We were bleeding quite a lot. It was fantastic. I feel deeply sorry for anyone whose childhood didn't involve large amounts of dirt.
Yeah.
It definitely formed me.
Cool. Yeah. Sounds nice. Awesome. Okay. What is the kindest thing someone has ever done for you?
It's the day I became homeless.
Yeah.
My boss gave me a place to sleep. That was extraordinary.
Okay, can you go into that a little bit more?
I was in a very bad situation and I had to get out of the place where I was living.
Mm.
And I told my boss, and she told me to go upstairs at the place I was working, which was a children's center. And there was a little room upstairs with a small kitchen and a sofa that the staff used for breaks. And she said, you should go out there and you should sleep here as long as you want. Which at that time, for various reasons, I wouldn't have had anywhere else to go.
Yeah.
So, and I still remember, very, very, very vividly being upstairs in this little break room and making beans on toast and being incredibly happy.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, I was free of this god-awful situation I'd been in domestically. Okay. And second of all, because this was a moment that was like authentically mine.
Yeah.
And that had been given to me without any expectation of return or reward or anything. Someone had just given this, like, this sofa and this pot of beans in this kitchen to me and just said, yeah, just stay as long as you want. I ended up staying one night, was all I needed. Sometimes you just need
You can, like, time to just work out your situation. And
I didn't even need time. I just needed to be welcome somewhere.
Yeah.
Which I was.
Yeah. That's nice.
Thanks.
Cool.
Thanks, Rosie.
Yeah, have you told her that ever?
Oh, she knows. She knows. She's very wise. We understand each other great. We talk on Facebook now.
Yeah?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, like all people.
Like everyone does.
Yeah. Nice. Have you got any questions you want to ask me?
Yeah, I want to know what you would say about the 5-year thing. You put me on the spot with that one.
Yeah. Why haven't I prepared an answer for this?
Yeah.
Nightmare. Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought so much about the reading thing, which is quite a nice insight from your side. I do think, I'm not sure if VR will be good enough by then, but it's definitely, having played with VR, it's really encompassing when you're in that world. And as AI is getting better and better, maybe 5 years, like 10 years time, thing like UBI, and maybe we will live in more of a state where people just live in these virtual reality worlds because it's more interesting and there's something for them to do there. But in 5 years, it's still a bit too soon. And I think the trends of that coming will be starting. I'm not sure, something I've really been recognizing lately is lack of experience being in the moment. And so I'll be traveling and you'll see people in these really cool places. Like there was this swing on the edge of the cliff next to a waterfall, and like, these people will get on it for like half a second, get their phone, take some photos and get off it. And you're like, but you're swinging over the edge of a cliff. Do you not want to do that for like maybe 30 seconds and enjoy it rather than just taking a photo of you pretending to enjoy it and then dealing with your phone for the rest of the holiday? Like, I think.
Oh, yeah. Like posing is cheating.
Yeah.
Posing is like, and I know like this must piss people off, but I just, I don't see a posed photograph as a real photograph.
No.
Like, unless you're like, okay, there are, unless you're like Leibovitz, right? Okay, unless you're like a professional, the woman who does the Vanity Fair pictures, yeah, like front covers every year. No, fine, like, fine. If you're like shooting a supermodel, pose away. But it's a whole art form in itself. And it's only one style of photography. And the idea that I'll shoot a good portrait, like, or my friend will shoot a good portrait of me sat on this swing you're talking about, is as absurd as thinking that, like, if you give me a video camera, I'll make the next Titanic.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, of course I won't. Like, there's no way. There's no point. Don't do that. Mm. Far better to just, like, photograph things that are really happening.
Yeah, yeah. So I feel like, hopefully someone will find a way to fix that so that people can focus more on enjoying themselves more rather than just creating a whole set of content to show off to their friends that doesn't really matter about. But I'm worried it's going to carry on further in the other direction.
In a way though, you know, you could see this another way, which is if the only place in which there is a kind of social life is online, is through social media.
Yeah.
Creating social currency to spend in that social sphere is not dumb.
Mm.
This is the thing, you see. Like, I don't think these people are being stupid. What we need to ask is, why is that the only means of social expression? Why is that the only social space? And that's a far more difficult question to answer. Mm. You know, yes, Facebook is occupying an enormously important place in people's life, a place that would once have been filled by, you know, community, trade unions, sports teams,
talking to people.
Enormous. Yeah. But why was that space vacant?
Yeah.
That's the question.
And so far not come up with any real useful predictions. I do think cryptocurrencies will carry on getting bigger. I'm not sure if any of the ones that are currently around will actually be useful by then, and they'll have something much better. And currently all the ICOs that have come out have failed to really produce anything that people actually want to use.
Mm.
So as in, you'll buy these tokens just because of your hope it'll go up in value and you can sell it. No one's buying tokens in an ICO to actually use the product of the company. So I think there's going to be a real kickback on that, and people actually start only wanting things that they can use as the blockchain becomes more useful. And
yeah, still feel like Facebook could somehow become less useful.
Whereas Amazon, I think, is only going to get bigger. Definitely the way they invest in sort of things everywhere.
But people would have said that about Microsoft. People would have said Microsoft were untouchable.
Mm.
Absolutely untouchable when I was a kid. They really didn't seem like anyone could take that off them. Who would Google, right? It was just some search engine, just some nothing. You know, what was Amazon? Some stupid company you buy books off.
Mm.
Even Apple. I remember when Apple was a joke.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you think it changes so much quicker than it. Like, I can't remember who said this, but someone said, nothing seems to change, and then everything does.
Yeah.
And that's how it happens. So I'm not sure I can get as behind the inescapability of Amazon. What might happen, I think, is we might end up with something like full communism by the back door.
Yeah.
You know, if there is only one company and we all work for it, what's the difference between that and Stalinism, really?
True.
So maybe that will happen, but I'm not so sure.
Yeah. I do always get annoyed by Apple and their products.
Just let me open my computer.
Yeah.
All I want is to be able to open my computer and break it. Like, if you take that power away from me, then I get ends. Why do you hate it?
It just seems necessarily expensive and limiting compared to Windows.
Yeah.
The only reason I have a Mac is just so I can make apps for iPhone.
Yeah, I've never spent any money on an Apple product, and I never will.
Mm.
Let me break my stuff. Like, this is how people learn. People learn by fucking up. Okay. You take away the ability to fuck up, you take away the ability of people to learn.
Do you think Trump will still be in power?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. He's hanging by a thread. But what do I know? You know, I'm not a Washington insider. You know, I'm a humble, occasionally humble teacher.
Do you think North Korea will still be playing around with nuclear weapons?
I just try not to think about that, you know. Yeah, as somebody who lives in Southeast Asia, I want to think as little as possible about that, you know. We're probably okay where we are. But yeah. only people who have no idea of the scientific realities of modern nuclear weapons can even contemplate a nuclear war with anything other than
it seems so ridiculous. Like, if they do launch anywhere, then they'll be destroyed.
Not only that, the biosphere will collapse. I think it takes 12 nuclear weapons to trigger a nuclear winter. It doesn't take very much at all. You know, there's however many thousand in the world. So
yeah, we've been playing a game of like kind of stalemate, hoping they'll never go further now. They kind of got too big to really ever attack, and it's like we can just hope that they don't do anything more.
If 12 nuclear weapons fall, I'll kill myself. Probably kill myself that afternoon. Yes.
Would you not like the idea of having a bunker which you could live in for 30 years and just
It's over. It's over. At that point, like, we reach the end of our cycle. And then
Musk would need to weapon is getting to Mars.
Or we just become sane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. What corrective powers are there? You know, I have to, because of my background, I have to believe that there is something called democratic power, which provides a check on the insane exigencies of our leaders, but perhaps there isn't. And perhaps we have just had a good run. But I'm not joking, like, no one survives a nuclear war. No one survives a full-scale nuclear war. We're all dead. It's just a question of whether you draw out the suffering or you just do it that afternoon. I'm all in favour of doing it that afternoon.
Yeah, any normal person. But you think, like, the president could be away in his... near the mountain that they have for like nuclear safety.
So, what's he president of? Yeah, he's nowhere now. He's just
that he'll be alive along with his guards and a few scientists and doctors for the next 30 years.
Great, sounds fantastic. No, count me out. Count me out. Yeah. Like, what's he going to do up there? You know.
But as in, if enough humans can survive in bunkers, to then repopulate the Earth in like 30 years' time.
What are you coming back to? What are you coming back to if the ecological system is completely collapsed? What are you coming back to? Your, like, best case scenario, you're coming back to a form of serfdom more miserable than any that ever existed in human history.
We're coming back to, like Eden Project bubbles or something, and then you can kind of live in just like a little oasis.
Yeah, and I might win the lottery.
True.
I can, you know, if that was all I was living for, hope of that, I'd also kill myself. Voice,
to carry on the human race.
Why are we so great? Why are we so important? I've never really understood this. You know, like, what's so awesome about humans? It's just, we're just, anyway. You know, if what you think is awesome is life, then I might get behind that. Life is awesome. You know, if we had a semblance of reason, we'd be just firing the hardiest bacteria that Darwinism has produced at what looked like the most livable planets, and we'd be doing it. Right. We'd be doing it five times a day. You know, boom, boom, boom. Just take aim and fire. Like, because life is good. Life is good. Are humans good? I'm not sure. I'm not even convinced.
Yeah.
Some humans are good. Some forms of human society are pretty good. But like, they could go wrong at any time and do. And if they go wrong in a planet-ending way, it's probably better for everyone that we die than get to Mars. You know, sorry, Elon, but why do we want to spread the plague further if that's what we're doing?
Yeah.
If it's not what we're doing, then we better hurry up.
That's very interesting view. Wow. Cool.
Cool.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting to say that. Yeah. I mean, yeah, the pointless... this of human existence is large, but I
never said pointless.
Well, lack of clarity as to why we're here and what we're doing beyond just keeping ourselves alive and making more of us.
I think this is certainly not the end state of us.
Okay.
It's not supposed to be. Transcendence, man. Transcendence. Whatever transcendence means to you. We're supposed to transcend this.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to be... I'm not supposed to care. Like, we've got a president of the United States who goes on national television and talks about how big his cock is. I'm sorry, man. You've got to transcend this stuff at some point.
Yeah.
Like, whatever transcendence means to you, it's not that. But functionally, that's how some people live their lives.
Yeah.
I think the majority of us realize that that's not really right or not really on. But if we don't transcend it, and if we allow ourselves to be led by that impulse, then let's clear some space. Mm. I don't think it's right to stick around. It's certainly not right to inflict it on any other fledgling forms of life which might be crawling themselves free of the ooze. No, just send the bacteria out. The bacteria, now there's hope there. You know, somewhere scuttling on the depths of the Marinara Trench is pure life.
Yeah, maybe we're just the result of some bacteria that was sent here from some wise thing.
No protein without DNA, no DNA without protein. You explain that. Yeah. You're the biologist.
It's the random chemical reaction that somehow made some protein that was just about able to like make some other protein that made more of the first protein. And
some random chemical reaction. That's an interesting name of God. That's a new one on me. Soup. I know the guy's got 100, but some random chemical reaction is a new one on me.
Yeah. Well, of the billions of years and molecules across the entire universe, sort of kind of unlikely to happen. But then, yeah, maybe like the Elon Musk, we're all in the computer game. But then, where did that first?
So transcend that. Anyway, transcend that. Like, whatever you're in, transcend it. That's what you're here for. You're not really here for. You're not here to accumulate the biggest pile of bullshit or the biggest missile or whatever. Yeah.
Cool.
It's
like at the point. Not sure what it is, but it's there. Good times. And it's New Year's. Any New Year's resolutions?
Exactly the same as everyone else. Whoever is listening to this, if anyone is listening to this, whatever you're thinking of, I'm definitely planning the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. We're all the same.
Okay.
Oh, come on. Are you telling me that anyone's isn't eat less, drink less, gym more? Of course.
I've already done too much of that, I think. Oh, yeah, maybe I could eat a little bit less.
There you go. See, we're all the same. More... Well, I'll tell you what, my grandmother, I can't tell you mine, but my grandmother has no vices that I know of at all. I'm not even joking. She has no vices. I think not having vices is her vice. And so she only makes positive New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
So she does not give anything up. She just does new things.
More focusing on like kind of being more grateful for things. And
she writes letters.
Yeah.
She writes a letter every day. So she might make a New Year's resolution to write 5 more letters a week. That might be her resolution. I feel like you get a vanishingly small number of people like my grandmother. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm
sure. I'm going to try and be like her.
Yeah, do it.
And hopefully inspire other people to do that too.
So that's the end of the conversation with Rob. In case you didn't notice, this was released 6 months after New Year's when it was recorded. So I do wonder how many of Rob's predictions were accurate for you guys at home. And I certainly hope that we all did better on average than he predicted. So, on to my top tips. Number one, optimize your aid giving. So on the subject of giving aid or helping out, try to be as useful as possible. If you want to visit a country and physically help out, you should develop some specific skills. Don't just go somewhere on like a glorified holiday where you mainly just get in the way. You would net make far more beneficial difference by just sending your money to a charity and then just going on a holiday yourself instead. 2. Let people break stuff. So this is a solid piece of advice from an actual teacher. Just let people make their own mistakes and learn through messing up, because it's just far more empowering than keeping them in an enclosed system. 3. Make positive resolutions. Instead of focusing on the negative, try to find things that can make you happier and more useful to others, or just build better connections or add a skill. As Rob says, there should be more people like this in the world, so hopefully we can be those people. Okay, and now on to books. So just a quick summary of what the books were so you can write them down in case you forgot. The first was H.P. Lovecraft's Whisperer in the Darkness, which is the one about fungoid insects stealing people's brains, which sounds really cool and a bit ridiculous. And then the other main book we spoke about was David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, which we spoke at length, and you probably don't need my summary. Cool, so that's it. If you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with others. And we do now have a YouTube channel, which is news, and it features some of my favourite questions from each podcast. So if there is one section you thought was really useful, you should be able to find it there. All right, peace and love.
You've listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to reach out, I'd love to talk to you. On Twitter, I am at SamHarrisTweets, or Instagram, SamJamSnaps. Show notes, along with links to everything that we discuss, are available at growthmindsetpodcast.com, along with information on how to get involved and blog posts on cool things that you should be aware of. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy your next podcast.